we have to do that because none of us are so skillful that we can be constantly creating perfectly formed sentences as we speak. And if we are, it's probably because we said the same thing hundreds of times before. Teaching these strategies would seem to be an extremely useful way of helping learners get a sort of, as I say, a kind of foothold into conversation.
Hello, and welcome to ELT WTF. This week, WTF stands for Ways to Fluency. I get to chat to Scott Thornbury about discourse analysis and why it reveals that conversation is very different from how we often imagine it to be. I loved having this chat with Scott, which covers some theory, but also a lot of practical classroom implications. Scott is a teacher trainer, ELT conference rockstar, and an author of some of my favourite books about teaching, including Big Problems in ELT and Teaching Unplugged. However, I started by asking him about the book that inspired this interview, Conversation from Description to Pedagogy.
Yeah, it's a good question, Tim, and I'm glad you've focused on this book because it tends to get a little bit neglected, I have to say. I mean, actually, the idea of it was hatched in the back of a car on New Year's Day in South Australia, where we're coming back from spending the night with friends. And Diana, my co-writer, I'd known for a number of years, and she works in the University of Technology in Sydney. But our paths had crossed on a number of occasions, and her interest in the spoken language from perhaps a more theoretical point of view, and I can come back to that in a minute, coincided with my interest in teaching fluency, basically, and teaching the speaking skills. And so, I mean, we coming from two different points of view, very much her, as I say, being more theoretically inclined. She'd done her PhD dissertation on the subject of gossip, of all things, and had used a corpus of data she'd collected in Australia. I had been, as I said before, working as a teacher trainer primarily, but you know, when as this field, you're always interested and challenged by students' need to become more fluent. And so we kind of hatched this idea that we'd approach it from these two points of view, from the theoretical description, if you like, of what constitutes not speaking generally, but casual conversation, given that's probably the kind of default setting for spoken language. And then come at it from having described that from a kind of pedagogical point of view, look at, well, okay, so that's what it looks like, spoken language. How do we actually teach it? So hence the strap line in the book, Conversation from Description to Pedagogy. So to say, writing a very busy co-writer who was also a mother of two living on the other side of the world, trying to find times when we could actually communicate. And it did involve actually my taking advantage of going back to Australia on a couple of occasions, since we spent a weekend holed up in another beach place, arguing the toss about systemic functional linguistics. Can you imagine? How sad is that? But where Diana comes from, she's very much in that Hallidayan paradigm, which is common to many people in Australia, since Michael Halliday worked from Australia, recently died, sadly. And so he had basically founded the School of Systemic Functional Linguistics. Diana was heavily invested in the Halliday's Systemic Functional Linguistics. I was less so, although I was interested, also wary writing a book that was theoretically committed to only one point of view. So I wanted to kind of stretch the theoretical base a bit to sociolinguistics, etc. stuff. And this is hence, we didn't always see eye to eye, but we had some fascinating conversations and we've still remained friends ever since.
The starting point for this book is discourse analysis. And when I first read this book as a rookie teacher, I thought, what on earth does this have to do with teaching? What is discourse analysis and what does it have to do with teaching?
Good. Well, I'm glad you, yes, identified that link, because in fact, I went on to become more and more interested in discourse and actually wrote another book called Beyond the Sentence on that subject. And Beyond the Sentence, to me, captures what discourse analysis is all about. Traditionally, descriptions of language, particularly for teaching purposes have been at the level of the sentence or the word or the phoneme or whatever, but they don't go beyond the sentence. But of course, language and use is more than just sentences. In fact, it's whole conversations if it's spoken, or it's texts and the texts that respond to them if it's written. And of course, now in our multimedia kind of multimodal age, it's a combination of both spoken and written and visual text, if you like. So discourse analysis takes us into that area, looking at how texts are constructed, whether spoken or written. What do speakers and writers know about language at that level that helps them become good speakers and writers or good conversationalists? And what of this body of knowledge can we communicate to our learners? Given, of course, that our learners come from languages which also operate beyond the sentence, and so they will share many features. I mean, one of the things that I argued about with Diana is that a lot of the features of conversational English are common to other languages. I mean, turn-taking, for example. I don't think that there's not a single language which doesn't take turns when people speak. They don't shout on top of each other all the time and stuff like that. And of course, how it's done in different cultures may be slightly differently, where, say, for example, silence is tolerated longer in some cultures, etc. But I mean, essentially, the basics of conversation are universal. And similarly, you could say to a perhaps lesser extent, but written texts also follow more or less similar conventions. And the conventions are determined by the reader as much as the writer. What is it the reader needs to know? And if the writer keeps the reader in mind, then of course the writer will make those kinds of adjustments. So discourse analysis, as I say, is about all those things. It's about putting text together. It's about making text cohesive, that is to say, linking one sentence to the next, making them coherent, that is to say, taking the reader's knowledge or the listener's knowledge into account when we construct a text so that they understand it maximally, as well as, of course, being able to compose grammatically well-formed sentences and so on all the way down. So, I mean, yeah, it's the area that teachers perhaps deal with without knowing it when they're teaching writing. For example, if they're teaching academic writing, if they're teaching five-paragraph essay, if they're teaching those kinds, they're dealing with discourse because they're dealing with language beyond the sentence, but they might not call it discourse analysis. And they need not. But as long as they're dealing with language beyond the sentence, of course, they are fulfilling their learners' needs in this area.
When you talk about conversation in this book, you say it's not just a simplified version of English. Can you say why?
I mean, for a long time, the assumption has always been in terms of teaching languages that if you teach the rules of grammar and you teach sufficient vocabulary, then kind of speaking will take care of itself. Learners will express their intentions using the grammar and slotting in the relevant vocabulary. But of course, one of the problems was that, well, first of all, the grammar that we used to teach and still do to a large extent is the grammar of written English, not the grammar of spoken English, which is actually very different. And that's one of the things that we explored in this book. You know, what is it that constitutes the grammar of spoken English and how is it different from written English? So that's one of the problems. But nor is it the case that even if you do identify the grammar correctly and teach the grammar of spoken English, that it will automatically be realized as fluent conversation. There's a long stage of practice that has to take place before those, you know, the facts of the language, if you like, are kind of activated and are available for use in real time. And that's one of the challenges, of course, in terms of teaching fluency. We can teach as much grammar and vocabulary as we want, but unless it's practiced in conditions of psychological authenticity, that is to say, the kinds of conditions in which it will be used in the real world, then it's very little likelihood of that knowledge being activated. So that is why traditional approaches to teaching speaking, which A, didn't focus on the features of spoken language specifically, and nor did they practice them sufficiently so that they could be activated in real time. That was one of the problems we tried to address in this book. And actually, just as a footnote, I've just been writing an article for a handbook on the history of, well, on materials for teaching spoken language. And it's amazing, actually. You go back 50 years and you find there's no materials in course books which target speaking specifically. There may be an activity, say, like talk amongst yourselves about X, Y, and Z, but there's nothing that actually targets speaking as a separate skill. It just has a speaking activity. It's only much more recently, and it's because of the advent of things like discourse analysis, and also because of the advent of corpus linguistics and the ability now to capture large extracts of spoken language, that we're better informed about the difference between spoken and written English. And now any good grammar that's worth its salt will identify features of spoken grammar, spoken language, which are not the same as they are in written language, and vice versa.
Why is it that in the past we didn't think of spoken English as being very different to other forms of language?
Well, I think that's the prestige that's always been accorded the written form of the language, that it is the form to which an education, even in our first language, we aspire, and the mark of an educated person is their ability to write text, not to speak, or maybe write text which are spoken subsequently, like speeches, etc. But it has always been thought that spoken language is somewhat messy, untidy, often ungrammatical, colloquial, etc. So it's got a bad reputation. And certainly when you transcribe naturally occurring conversation, it looks dreadful. I mean, on the page, it looks absolutely incoherent. You think, are these people drunk or what? So yes, so I think that's very much the reason it has had low prestige. And it's only more recently that people are starting to look at spoken language as a genre, if you like, in its own right. And actually, what's interesting now, of course, is that with new media like email, text messaging, blogging, et cetera, even written language has become much more what one writer called conversationalized. That is to say, written language now takes on many of the features. And then, you know, if you taught business English 20 or 30 years ago, as I once did, you were teaching people to write formal letters, which were actually typewritten out. My esteemed client, et cetera, yours faithfully, et cetera. Nobody does that now, not in English anyway, because everything's done very quickly, very informally through email. So, yeah, so there's been a kind of collapse of the difference, I think, between spoken and written English to a large extent.
One of the things in these books that I found interesting were things that you read and think, oh, I don't do that. One example is something you categorize anecdote, which is a story that doesn't really need any kind of resolution. You might say, oh, do you remember that guy lives down the road? I remember reading that and really thinking, I don't do that at all.
Right.
And then noticing myself do it a bunch over the next couple of weeks.
Well, that's right. Well, it's so much of conversation between friends particularly, but even between people who don't know each other that well, has a social function rather than a kind of informative function. There's what used to be called, or still is called in the literature, phatic, phatic, that it's there simply to lubricate the wheels of social intercourse, that social intercourse, I said. All these things that we do that are never really written down, I suppose in letters and emails and that, we start by saying, hi, how are you, what's news, etc. And that would be phatic, if you like. But a lot of what we do is, of course, transactional when we write, unless we're writing. But spoken language, a huge amount of it, you listen to any conversation, and even when people tell stories, they're not telling stories because it's a kind of like important information that they actually have to transmit. It's often with the purposes of getting a laugh or eliciting sympathy. This is often the case with these stories you mentioned where there's no conclusion. So this is very much a feature of women's talk, allegedly, where women tell stories which elicit about, you know, things that went wrong, self or embarrassing incidents and things like that, because they elicit solidarity with the other women that they're talking to. When men tell stories, they tend to be about things that went wrong and how the male overcame them heroically. To elicit awe, envy, and so on. I mean, that's a terrible stereotyping, but there does seem to be evidence of people who've researched gender and language that this is the case, that there's a tendencies in the way that people tell anecdotes and in casual conversation.
Oh, yeah, and I don't think it's a bad thing to say that language is gendered in a lot of ways. Another thing I found really interesting was you talk about the difficulty of English conversation even for people who have been speaking English their entire lives. There's a quote you've got here that talks about coping with one of the greatest problems of all, speaking at normal rates in real time.
Well, I mean, that's a good question, and it's a hard thing to do, as you suggest, not just in the second language, but in the first language too. And it's interesting, if you look at all the books that are available in kind of airline, airport, bookstores and things on being a good conversationalist, and it's not just about, of course, what you say, it's about how you say it, it's about body language, and it's about the ability to listen as much as to speak. And of course, we all know people who never listen when they talk, just simply rabbit on. And so the ability to be a good conversationalist in your first language is, perhaps you could say, an acquired skill. Certainly in the second language, it's compounded by the fact that learners don't have ready access to the words, structures, phrases, etc. they need in real time. And I mean, that's the real challenge with conversation. It's happening in real time and it's interactive. You've got to be listening just as much as speaking, and you've got to be pitching whatever you're saying to your audience where the conversation is at the moment. And I think those of us who learn second languages and been in positions of trying to use them in conversation are all familiar with the syndrome where you think what people are talking about is football and you're preparing your little contribution. You drop it into the conversation, beautifully formed. Of course, the topic's moved on. Now they're talking about dog breeding. They look at you like, what? Where have you been for the last 5 minutes? So this is the real problem is the real timeness of spoken language. And that's why the classroom needs to be a place where learners get maximum practice at speaking extempore, that is spontaneously, and preferably on their feet in conditions of what I call before psychological authenticity. I mean, we do have conversations sitting down, but we do a lot of speaking, moving around, standing up with a lot of background noise, more than one person, you know, in groups, etc., about topics that we may not be quite on top of and so on. So learners do need that kind of practice. If all the practice they're getting in speaking is like reading aloud dialogues, for example, they're not going to be sufficiently prepared for the real world out there, which is cruel.
How do you think we do as a profession in terms of dealing with conversation as opposed to other forms of language?
Well, I mean, we've done badly in the past because the feeling was, because of all these problems and difficulties of conversation, that, and also, you know, teachers' experience of having put learners in positions of, say, okay, talk to each other and seeing them completely and utterly clam up, that often conversation is something that's postponed. It's postponed both in terms of the lesson, so it's like that add-on in the last 3 minutes, or it's postponed in terms of the syllabus, where the idea is, well, we'll teach the language, the grammar and the vocabulary and the pronunciation, etc., for 4 years or 8 years or whatever, and then we'll let the learners off the leash, as it were, on the assumption that now they've got enough language that they can run with it. Of course, they can't. We all know. We're all very familiar with context where learners have been learning at school languages since they were 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, and they come out at the other end and they can't maintain a conversation for 2 seconds. And that's not just a characteristic of Asian educational systems. It's certainly the case here in Spain, and I would say probably a lot of places. So we've been remiss, I think, in the past. The communicative approach did a lot to remedy the weaknesses of previous methodology by foregrounding fluency over accuracy and saying, look, come on, guys, it doesn't matter in the end. Nobody's going to die if you leave off the third person S. But what's more important is to get your meaning across. Of course, that's all very well in certain contexts and other contexts, more formal ones. People say, well, no, you can't. You've got to be absolutely 100% correct if you're having a job interview and stuff like that. So it became issues, perhaps appropriately became the benchmark of good language use rather than accuracy or even fluency. But I mean, I think so communicative approach did do a lot to redress the balance. But again, the communicative approach only lasted 10 years effectively before it was kind of traduced by the return to the grammatical syllabus and a re-emphasis on accuracy. I think where spoken language is taught best, my suspicion is in ESP classes, that is say English for specific purposes. If you have identified that your learners who are business people, let's say, have to give presentations and also they have chit chat in restaurants and in conference, you know, breaks, etc., then you're going to really work on that. And you're going to simulate those situations and you're going to have them doing presentations in the class and you're going to show them how a presentation is constructed. So that's, I think, where it's happening. I think in general English classes, sometimes it's difficult to think, well, what is it that the learners want to do with their language? Well, I think the bottom line is they're going to have conversations. Let's foreground conversation. Let's start the lesson with a conversation. It's not rocket science to be able to get a conversation going, even with low-level learners. If you're helping them and scaffolding what they're saying just by talking about what they did last weekend.
When most people learn to speak their first language, they do it through conversation. There's a quote you use in your book about people learning conversation before they even learn their first language. Do you think that's something we should be mimicking in the language classroom?
Yeah, that's a great quote. That's Evelyn Hatch in 1987. She said, and she was looking at children in their first language from a discourse analysis point of view, looking at how conversations are constructed. She saw very early on that children are having, often with their parent, are having these kind of proto conversations, and out of those conversations, syntax kind of develops. And that was a major insight, and in a sense, it kind of validated the communicative approach. So maybe out of speaking, we can learn to speak rather than out of learning grammar or vocabulary. So that was one of the things I think that discourse analysis has helped us understand how, in first language at least, language development grows out of conversation. So why shouldn't it in a second language? I think the other thing that's happened significantly in the last 20 or so years has been a refocus on vocabulary as an important building block to fluency. And but not just vocabulary, but formulaic language. That is to say, what some people call lexical chunks, you know, phrases, formulae, these expressions that give us a sort of foothold, if you like, on fluency, because they allow us to pull down whole expression off the shelf, as it were, rather than try to construct it out of individual words, which of course takes time. And in real-time conversation, you don't have that luxury. So this was a really important discovery, which I still think hasn't totally been incorporated into materials design or pedagogy or curricular design. The idea that what the learner needs, initially at least, is a kind of repertoire of memorized phrases. I mean, it's a discovery that was made by Harold Palmer in the 1930s when he was teaching in Japan. It only got rediscovered by people like Michael Lewis in the 1990s and called the lexical approach. But the idea that we should be teaching learners a phrase book, at least initially, rather than a grammar, still hasn't really percolated, as I say, into curriculum design and materials design.
Even when chunks are taught, they're often taught as an I'm going to, and you kind of finish off the sentence yourself, rather than as a phrasebook. That kind of leads to the next question, which is about discourse strategies. What are discourse strategies, and how would you try and teach some of those in the classroom?
One of the things that was discovered when people listen to people talking, particularly learners talking, is that they use strategies to make up for or to help them cope with the demands of real-time processing when they're having a conversation. And so when fluent speakers, I just did it then, they backtrack, they start a sentence again, they pause, they fill the pause by either repeating a word or a syllable, or with expressions like etc. But they don't leave the pause empty, because if they did, then somebody else would leap in. So these are all kinds of, if you like, communication strategies or discourse strategies which we use to help us overcome the demands of real-time processing. And every language learner does them, and they do them in their first language. They don't realize it. Again, this goes back to that question you asked before. Why is it that written language is prioritized over spoken language? Because spoken language has all these disfluencies, if you like, which make it seem ungrammatical and generally inarticulate. But it's not. We have to do that, because none of us are so skillful that we can be constantly creating perfectly formed sentences as we speak. And if we are, it's probably because we said the same thing hundreds of times before. Teaching these strategies would seem to be an extremely useful way of helping learners get, as I say, a kind of foothold into conversation. Learning how, for example, to change the subject by using discourse markers, things like saying, by the way. So if you don't want to talk about politics or football or whatever, you can, and you want to talk about dogs, then you can say, by the way, did you see that program last night on dogs? And these are kind of really useful strategies. It's often just teaching the language that we use to initiate those strategies, because as I say, they tend to be universal. And of course, there's a danger, as some people have pointed out, in teaching learners to become too reliant on these strategies, that they will become, you know, we've all met students or learners who use you know more than they perhaps you know ought to, you know, because they're you know using it you know as a filler. Just as in first languages, in English as a first language, many younger speakers use like all the time, like when they're talking like, because again, it like fulfills the same like function. So these strategies can be overused. And so, but I mean, I think in some ways it's better to overuse them than underuse them. I mean, we can always rein in the learners later. But I think, yeah, teaching strategic speaking, teaching the skills of communication through strategies is a really good way to go.
Yeah. And when you go to the average English classroom and look at inverted commas conversation, you might see one student talk for 2 minutes and the other one take a turn, or lots of very basic question answer conversations.
One of my favorite activities, it's pretty difficult even for native speakers actually, for more advanced learners, it's called obsessions. So students stand up and they're groups of about three or four, and you, on a card they have an obsession. It's the thing that they're obsessed about and they have to talk about. So it might be astrology, it might be veganism, it might be the royal family, it might be the World Cup, you see, but they don't know. So they got their card and they've got to launch into a conversation and they've got to try and keep their topic, the one that everybody's talking about, by using strategies like, by the way, oh, that reminds me, oh, did you hear about, etc. And it can be quite a laugh. But as I say, I mean, it's a very sophisticated skill.
Are there any other changes we need to make to the way we teach conversation?
Again, it comes back to this thing about not teaching conversation simply to practice grammar. I mean, this is one of the problems in the past, that we give students a speaking activity, but the underlying intention of it is to practice the present perfect continuous or the third bloody conditional. And I think, no, fine, yes, there is room for activities, practice activities, which are focused on recycling grammar. But if that's all the speaking that learners are doing, then that is not going to give them that kind of fluency they need, because they're constantly going to be thinking, oh, I've got to use the present perfect continuous or whatever. No, we want to have speaking activities where the focus is entirely on communicating something which is meaningful, relevant, personal to other people and sharing that knowledge. So it really does mean saying we've got to put grammar aside, vocabulary aside at strategic points in the curriculum and say, no, these are going to be activities which focus purely on the development of fluency.
This next question is going to sound like me asking you to do my job for me. But imagine you're teaching freshmen at a university and your boss comes up to you and tells you you'll be teaching conversation to IELTS students for 16 weeks. What would your first steps be in putting something together?
That's a great question. And it's a situation I think many teachers will be familiar with one way or the other. I think the worst thing you can do is go in on the first day and put the students into groups and say, talk to each other. I mean, that's not going to work even with native speakers or very advanced learners. About what? Why? With what means, etc. So it needs to be staged. But I think it should not be staged in the way that often traditionally is done, which is like, oh, we'll teach them a lot of grammar first and then they can use it to talk to each other. No, for all the reasons I've been saying. So maybe what you do teach them is some of these communication strategies, and you teach them some of these expressions which are really useful and common in conversation, like actually, and these back channel devices. So when they're listening to somebody, they say things like, right, yeah, oh, wow, interesting. I mean, I have this activity called conversational tennis. I've been doing it for years and I kind of dreamed it up, but I mean, it's very, very obvious, where you play them two recordings, one of people just doing, yes, question, answer, like a police interrogation. Where are you from? I'm from New Zealand. What do you do? I'm a teacher. How long have you been teaching? Blah, 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 that kind of conversation. And then you have the same conversation, which is more conversational in the sense that people use back channel devices. So where are you from? I'm from New Zealand. Oh, really? And that they also return the question. Oh, and so where are you from? And that they also add more than one piece of information. So where are you from? I'm from New Zealand, but I live in Spain. Now, if you teach them those three rules, that is to say, show interest by back channeling, return the question, and then supply more than one piece of information. If you get them doing those three things, I call it conversational tennis, because it's going, the ball's going backwards and forwards, but it's not, and it's reciprocal, and it's much more natural. And those are three very, 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 very basic techniques to teach. So in your conversation course, I would teach those and have them practice, and practice them maybe in very controlled circumstances. Like the other thing, my favorite activity in the world, and I didn't invent this, is paper conversations, I call them, where students have conversations in groups of three at the beginning of the lesson, but instead of speaking them, they're writing them as if they were texting. So there's one piece of paper that's going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, and they're writing questions and answers on it. So what did you do in the weekend? I went to Valencia, whatever. And then you can take those paper conversations and say, okay, great, those are great. Now tidy them up, add some back channel devices, add where could you put more than one piece of information? Where could you return the question, et cetera? So they're using the conversations that they've created, real conversation, but they're trying to sort of sophisticate them by using some of these very basic techniques. One of the problems with materials is we don't expose them to examples of real or real-like conversations. As I said before, if we gave them transcripts of real conversations, they would go cross-eyed. I mean, nobody can read those things. They look terrible. But if we tidy them up a bit, then we can show them, yeah, even native speakers make false starts. They repeat themselves. They get interrupted. and so on. So if we had more authentic data, and there's no reason why we can't get that now, because everybody's got a mobile phone, for heaven's sake, so they can record conversations. Teachers should be recording conversations constantly that they're having, preferably with the permission of the person they're recording, and then playing these to the class and giving them simplified transcriptions of them. Or they don't want to do that. They can make conversations with colleagues in the staff room, but not scripted and not with the point of including the present perfect continuous. So let's have a short conversation about last weekend. This is from my IELTS class, so, you know, pitch it accordingly. And so you have that conversation with your colleague. You've got it on your phone. You can play it to them. You can transcribe it, or they can transcribe it even, and they can do something similar. So it's sort of baby steps initially, but yeah, upping the ante constantly, and including moments in the class where people are just having chat for the sake of it. And the other thing, finally, Tim, I would just add, the other thing is that conversations take place in physical, of course, not ours is not at the moment, we can't see each other, but most people, when they converse, are conversing face to face, and they can get a lot of mileage out of doing paralinguistic things, that is to say, using the hands, using eye contact, using the shoulders, using their eyebrows, etc., to indicate when they're finished a turn, using their whole body. So there is something in this thing about body language, and it seems I can't quote chapter and verse on this, but people who have been judging a learner's fluency are often better disposed to say a learner is fluent if that learner gestured while they were speaking, as opposed to the learner who doesn't gesture. So there's other things to be taught, not, or to be encouraged at least, not just spoken language. It's the whole caboodle.
It was so great to have Scott on the show, and it was great to have you listen to it too. Next Friday, I'll be back talking to Mike Griffin about teacher training and how social media can help you develop as a teacher. If you've been enjoying the podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on the Apple Podcast Store. If you have any comments or questions, you can leave a comment at www.elt.wtf. Whiskey, soda, rock and roll.